Major funding for Soundings comes from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation and from the National Endowment for the Humanities. From the National Humanities Center, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations featuring scholars and visitors at the National Humanities Center. Women Work in the American City, two conversations this week on Soundings. First, a discussion with Sarah Deutsch of the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. Following that, a discussion with Virginia Vallian of Hunter College. During a recent fellowship year at the National Humanities Center, Sarah Deutsch worked on a study entitled Women of Boston, Gender and the City, 1870 through 1950. I asked Sarah Deutsch about the practice of women's history today.
Well, a lot of people would be comforted by the notion that this was a fad, something that would disappear, that they would no longer have to deal with or don't need ever to address currently. But in fact, I think one of the great successes of women's history has been its ability to intrude itself onto the general historical discourse and make it clear that the sexual difference that exists has been used by all societies to distribute rights and resources, mm-hmm. and that unless you incorporate some kind of analysis of sexual difference into your examination of historical dynamics, change over time, political, economic, or social change, you're going to miss a crucial feature of why things change uh-huh. and of how they change.
Sally Deutsch, let's turn to what you are doing here at the Humanities Center. You're looking at, it's a history of women in Boston, from roughly the middle of the 19th through the middle of the 20th century. Tell me about the goals of what you're doing here.
Well, it's not really simply a history of women. It looks at the relationship between sex and space and power in Boston. And so it looks at the relationships between men and women of different groups and how they achieve power in the city or how they're restricted from achieving power. And what the relationship between that and the changing spatial distribution of the city is.
Are you talking about what? Who was the mayor and who was not the mayor? Are you talking about who ran the social circles? Give me a concrete sense
right,
of what you're after.
I'm talking about a number of different levels. Everything from the relationship between workplace and home place. If you're a woman garment worker, which might be a stretch of the imagination, Wayne, but if you're a woman garment worker in the 1890s and in some ethnic neighborhood and the garment industry suddenly decided it was better off in the suburbs than downtown because there had been a number of strikes or because land was cheaper in the suburbs, then where are you going to go to work mm-hmm. where you can both have childcare taken care of by neighbors, you can walk back and forth between home and workplace, and you have a workplace where you're with co-ethnics?
Who made those decisions?
The companies made the decisions, largely, in the context of the changing economy of the city, and economy does come into this. And then how that transformation was dealt with also affected women's abilities to adapt to that change. So, for example, in the 1890s, I've come across women who said to women social workers, I would move five blocks away to be near a day nursery or a daycare center. So this problem, which we think of as so recent, access to daycare,
right.
is something that's in fact been quite continuous and has had its ups and downs in the historical record and affects something that we're concerned with now, which is how families fare economically, how many women are in the workforce, how possible it is for women to juggle work and home.
Now, you're not going to suggest, Sally Deutsch, that the men were all villains in this piece. Help me to understand the differences between the good guys and the bad guys in this scene that you've been setting.
Well, one of the things that I've found is that the newly traditional picture that we have of urban politics, where there's a sort of women's politics that is in voluntary organizations and reform organization, and a men's politics, which is machine politics and possibly a different kind of reform politics, are not as separate as we've been shown that they seem to have been, that there were organizations that were reform organizations that had both men and women in them, that that network of influential women and men were very close, usually by blood ties. They were sisters and brothers and cousins, particularly, it seems, particularly in Boston, but probably everywhere. And so there's a quite a spectrum of women in Boston who are involved in these things. There are reform-minded women who take in unwed mothers into their homes on Beacon Hill and find them work and rehabilitate them, who are also anti-suffrage. And then there are other women who are pro-suffrage but much less sympathetic to any working class.
Sally Deutsch, what do you mean by space? Do I hear a little psychobabble coming through in that? Or are you talking about places where women go to work? And help me to understand that.
Well, ideally, I would like to talk about how women perceived space as well as the physical aspects of space. But I'm more interested in basically in maps, in where women go to work, the relationship between work and home. A lot of women, petty entrepreneurs in Boston, worked in their homes. Work and home were the same thing. This is not a new phenomenon of women who go back to the home in the 1980s and open up a small store. Most women's stores in the 1880s were in their homes. And that kind of relationship, also the notion that as the city grew in the late 19th century, and it was differentiated more and more along ethnic and racial lines and class lines. You had middle class parts of the city and working class parts of the city, black parts of the city, Italian parts of the city. You also had male parts of the city and female parts of the city. And that the downtown area, for example, where city government took place and where businesses were, was a very male dominated part of town. And in the downtown area, women on the streets were all too often prey to the notion that they must be prostitutes. This was a real problem for working class women, for whom the boundary was always very vague and who had to be very careful of their reputation.
Is this the beginning of what we call the combat zone?
Well, the combat zone was the result of social purity movements that tried to limit that part of the city that was dangerous for middle class women to a particular area. But I suppose you could see the tensions that were arising from this as leading to that desire to say all space is safe but this space. But one of the things that women did to shape their environment in the late 19th century is that middle class women in particular began to construct women's club buildings downtown. It was a sort of female invasion of a male-dominated downtown, and they did this consciously to provide safe space for women to meet near the centers of power downtown, for them to come to lunch without being besieged by questionable male salesmen and other types, and for them to be able to meet to discuss issues that were often public. And these clubs were sort of mediators between the private realm, women's sphere, and the public realm of male politics.
Can you be specific for me, Sally Deutsch? Tell me about the kinds of materials that you were using. You may not want to name names, but what are you looking at in order to substantiate this narrative?
It's an eclectic bunch of resources. I'm looking at organizational records of women's organizations and organizations that had men and women in them. I'm looking at municipal records of municipal city council debates and Massachusetts legislature debates. And I'm looking at private collections of letters. There is a Catholic woman suffrage organizer named Margaret Foley who has a collection.
And not Fuller, but Foley.
Foley, right. and she gets hired by the Women's Suffrage Association in Massachusetts to go out and organize the Catholic women for the vote. And there end up being enormous tensions between them. She says, look, I have to do this through the churches. And they say, no, no, we want nothing done with the churches. Do it at the factories. And she says, no, that won't work because of this sort of gender hierarchy in the factories. And in the end, they fire her. It just doesn't work out.
Is there a particular reason or a general reason, Sally Deutsch, that you selected Boston as a place to look at issues of gender, women's history from the middle of the 19th century forward?
Boston had this reputation for being a women's city, a city where women were very powerful. Henry James, and it may say more about James than it does about Boston in particular, saw Boston as run by women. And it was a city which in this period was actually more or less in decline economically. It was being surpassed by other cities in terms of industry, in terms of shipping, but not in terms of culture, at least until the 1890s and 1900. And in that realm, women did have a lot of power in defining those attributes. It was also a city where women outnumbered men, and which was true of most, probably most major cities in the U.S. at the time. Women tended to be urbanized to a greater degree than men did because of labor opportunities and so forth. And it was a city where there was a large female working force.
How would you characterize the, what do we call it, the public discourse in Boston about issues of gender? Did that occur, what, on the street corners, in coffee houses, in the salons? How do you nail that sort of thing down?
Well, it occurred, as we're increasingly finding, as people begin to look at texts and look at the concept of discourse, we're discovering it occurs everywhere. It occurs in a formal way in the reporting of women's suffrage meetings or of women's rights meetings in Boston, in newspapers, in reports of women's appearances before the state legislature to get rights. But it occurs in more minor ways when settlement houses, for example, are trying to get neighborhood women, family women, to adhere more closely to what the settlement house workers think is the right mode of behavior, the right way to take care of their children, the right way to take care of their family. And that also is a sexual or gendered discourse. Linda Gordon's book on family violence is set in Boston. Her research was done in Boston, and that book is full of conflict between among families in Boston, which is gendered, and between those families and the social caseworkers who are responsible for finding ways out of the mess for those families.
Sally Deutsch, let's move toward a conclusion of our conversation, your study of gender, women's history in Boston. Design for me or trace for me a kind of an arc as you look at the history of women, issues of gender in Boston from the middle of the 19th into the middle of the 20th century. We start low and end high. How would you characterize that?
Well, I think we start one way and end differently is the way I would characterize it. I'm not one of these historians who sees continual progress being worked out.
Uh-huh.
There are trade-offs, even on the level of when in the 1850s you would have seen the most common women's profession being seamstresses and dressmakers. That profession more or less disappears around the turn of the century as you get increasing amounts of ready-made clothing and designer, even designer clothing. But what takes its place, those women don't just simply leave the workforce. What takes its place are beauty shops and hair salons, which become a feminine workplace instead of a masculine workplace that they had been before. And so you end up with a change, and it's not easy to say, is it better for these women to be in a beauty salon than
it
was for them to be a dressmaker?
Yeah.
You definitely have gone from a one-sex government in the formal terms of politics to a two-sex government. Women do have suffrage by 1950, and they are showing up in elective offices and as well as appointive offices, which they had begun showing up in at the turn of the century. And in that sense, there is some kind of advance in that representation. But it isn't always clear that what costs that advance was made with, how it transformed women's own views of themselves as a community, of women across all classes and races having a sort of common interest. That, I sense, has declined by 1950.
The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. You've been listening to a conversation with Sarah Deutsch of the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. During a recent fellowship year at the center, Sarah Deutsch worked on a study entitled Women of Boston, Gender in the City, 1870 through 1950. Soundings continues now with a conversation featuring Virginia Vallian of Hunter College. Virginia Vallian is the author of studies about gender, learning, and the psychology of work. Here is Virginia Vallian.
The way I originally got interested in this research was when I was working on my own thesis and having problems writing it. I seemed to be procrastinating endlessly.
Mm-hmm.
So,
of course, you're the only graduate student that ever happened to.
No, but I wanted to be sure that I was one of the ones who was going to make it through, because
right.
I did know other graduate students to whom it had happened and who didn't make it through. So I wanted to develop a program for myself that would allow me to make it through. In the past, I'd had a history of blitzing my way through assignments, which is something which is very common among college students in particular. But my thesis was something that I couldn't write the night before. So I had to develop another way of trying to cope with this problem.
Mm-hmm.
And I did. I developed a very simple technique based on reading Masters and Johnson's work on human sexual inadequacy.
Oh, my goodness.
So I made an analogy between work and sex and said, in the same way that sex is a natural human activity, work is a natural human activity. And so I do want to work, just as people want to have enjoyable sexual experiences. And I'm going to assume that there are internal blocks here that are standing between me and this natural enjoyment. And I will fashion a method based on Masters and Johnson's method also.
Well, you are a professor. It did work, I think.
It did work. Mm-hmm. But I decided I would concentrate simply on the enjoyment of working and that I would hold myself to working 15 minutes a day.
15 minutes a day.
That's all.
Modest goals.
Very modest goal. I was talking to the man I was living with, trying to think of an amount of time to work, and he said, well, how about 4 hours? And I said, 4 hours?
Too much.
If I could work 4 hours a day, I wouldn't have a work problem. I've got a really serious problem here. So he said, well, how about 2 hours? I said, forget it. I can't work 2 hours. So at this point, he was starting to lose interest because he couldn't imagine that you could get anything done working less than 2 hours a day. But we kept going down. And when it came down to 15 minutes, that seemed like an amount that I could faithfully do.
Virginia Valiant, help me to understand how you differentiate. Here we're talking about women, the psychology of work, feminism. We'll get onto that eventually. How do you differentiate between what we call work and what we call a job? To many people, they're the same thing. To other people, they're entirely different. Draw some distinctions for me.
I draw a distinction between work and job in the following way. To me, work is self-chosen activity which meets the goals and needs of what I refer to as one's true self. And I distinguish it from a job, which is primarily something that one does for external reasons, to earn money or to have a particular position in society, mm-hmm. All kinds of external reasons. Work is something that is intrinsically satisfying.
In your own life, do you have work or do you have a job?
I have both.
Mm-hmm.
So many aspects of my day are spent doing things which are not directly intrinsically satisfying.
Is one of them supposed to? Yeah, exactly. You're an academic. Is one of them supposed to what? Take precedence or to dominate? To have some sort of an emphasis so that we feel this what sense of satisfaction?
I think it's not so much that one of them needs to be dominant as that there has to be room for work in one's life in order for one to feel that in that part of one's life one is getting satisfaction.
Mm-hmm.
I consider the kinds of problems that I'm talking about to be something of a luxury in that most people have jobs. Most people don't have work. They're not doing something that they have freely chosen to do because of its intrinsic satisfaction.
Yeah, we're certainly not talking about the third world in or out of the United States. We're talking about people who have a kind of... Are we talking about people who are pampered? Let me put it to you that way. This luxury of... you know, sitting back and having time to figure out what is my job and what is my work.
I think it can sound that way, but although I've phrased it as a luxury, I wouldn't use the word pampered. And in fact, anybody who's ever tried to do intellectual or artistic work generally finds it to have many painful aspects. And people who don't do that sort of work, when you actually say to them, well, okay, imagine you go into your study in the morning and it used to be put the paper into the typewriter, now it's turn your computer on, and you now need to write a paper putting together the results of some experiment that you've worked on or whatever. Lots of people at that point say, well, no thanks, I'd rather be driving my cab and talking to people, or I'd rather have a job where it's clear what the goals are, what I'm supposed to do, when I'm supposed to have it done by, and so on. So I think that these problems are a luxury, but academic work is very, very difficult work.
What does feminism have to do with all of this? What about women and the psychology of work? Are they, in fact, one and the same thing, women and work and feminism?
No. Both men and women have what I call work problems. That is, both men and women have difficulty sitting down to their work and once they've sat down making progress at it. But the costs for men and women having those problems are different. And the Academy is one place where you can see the results of those different costs.
In what ways? Be specific for me.
Okay. The on all objective measures of status, salary, amount of time in a given rank, amount of time to tenure, prestige of institution, women fare worse than men do. Women make less than men at every rank, and that disparity increases with rank. Women stay longer in rank before being promoted than men do. It takes women longer to get tenure than it takes men.
What is this? The result of overt, deliberate discrimination? Do we use language like that?
On my analysis, currently, it's not the result of overt discrimination. There was overt discrimination in the past. I think now there isn't overt discrimination, but there's a lot of indirect bias, we might call it, which results in negative evaluations of women's equally good performance relative to men's.
Is this simply because the men outnumber the women in the academy? Are we counting by numbers? How do we figure these elements out, the quantity and the quality sort of thing?
It's difficult to do those analyses, and it's difficult to control for all the variables that are involved. The way that I have looked at the problem is there are two possible main causes that we can look at. One is direct and indirect bias against women, and the other is lower performance on the part of women, where lower performance is generally measured as lower research productivity, lower publication rate.
Well, there's where the irony may lie. Again, before our taping here for Soundings, Virginia Valley, and you told me that we use devices that we think are objective, that we think are going to be beneficial, productive, and offsetting problems such as discrimination in the workplace. And yet, they themselves yield an inequality. Now, have I got that right?
The way that the problem gets perpetuated, I can give you one somewhat longish answer to that, can be seen in how we interpret success and failure on the part of men and women. And that's the second part of how we go about confirming and disconfirming theories. When a man succeeds, that's something that we expect to have happen, because we see men as being successful and agentic individuals.
And God help him if he doesn't.
Well, we can get to that in a second. When a man succeeds, both he and we attribute his success to his ability, and perhaps to the fact that he put forth the right sort of effort. What that means is that when he's had a successful experience, since in memory we tend to code things that are similar together, and when an event occurs which is similar to those that we've got already stored in memory, we call all of those up. That means that when a man succeeds, what he calls up to mind are all the other occasions on which he was successful and that testify to his ability, and he then feels, rightly, confidence about the future.
And this doesn't happen to women?
That's right. When women are successful,
it's the exception rather than the rule.
That's right. That is, we perceive it that way, and we attribute, and the woman herself attributes, her success to luck, or to the task having been an easy task.
Well, how do we account for this difference? You said women feel, men act. Do we have what, a sort of an intuitive or an emotional accountability, quantification going on with women that we do not have with men?
Well, we are accounting for men also, but in a slightly different way. So when we're accounting for men and women in domains where women have traditionally been absent and men have traditionally been present, we attribute male success to their ability, to their knowing what to do.
To their maleness.
And at bottom, to their maleness. Uh-huh. That's right. And one place where this is this difference becomes particularly noticeable is when we try to predict a man's success and a woman's success in terms of the usual measures like salary, for example. And what we find when we are trying to account for male success is that we can do so using the kinds of measures that you'd expect would be relevant. For example, the prestige of the institution where they got their PhD, the prestige of the institution that they're at, how productive they've been, how much public service and administration they've done. All of those factors, exactly the ones that you'd think would predict somebody's success, do predict men's success. Those factors don't predict women's success nearly as well. The most important thing about a woman in academia is the fact that she's a woman.
Mm-hmm.
And it's much more important than for a man his maleness is.
Well, let's conclude on a note. We'll call up, we've had a sort of a name floating in and out of this conversation, Virginia Valley, and Mr. Freud. Let me paraphrase him. What do women want in their work? Is that simply too large a question to address? Is it germane to your interests?
I think women want what men want. They want the opportunity to do well, and they want their good performance to be recognized.
Virginia Valiant teaches at Hunter College of the City University of New York. She's the author of studies about gender and the psychology of work. The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Soundings is available on cassette. Send $4 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Ask for program number 456. The address again is the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. When writing, please mention the call letters of this radio station. Next week on Soundings, a discussion about political and social history in Europe and the United States. My guests will be Franklin Ford of Harvard University and William Luchtenberg of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Soundings concludes now with Timeline, a weekly cultural retrospective. The last week in June marks an anniversary for Custer's Last Stand, which occurred on the Little Bighorn River in Montana in late June 1876. One horse, reportedly named Comanche, survived the attack. The last week in June is the anniversary of the beginning and the ending of World War I, which began in 1914 and formally concluded in late June 1919. The St. Lawrence Seaway was dedicated by President Dwight D. Eisenhower and Queen Elizabeth II during the last week in June 1959. Finally, the English writer George Orwell, the American novelist Pearl Buck, the Irish nationalist Charles Stuart Parnell, and the French philosopher Jean-Jacques Rousseau have birthdays during the last week in June. George Orwell was born in 1903, Pearl Buck in 1892, Charles Stuart Parnell in 1846, and Jean-Jacques Rousseau in 1712. Until next week, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Support for Soundings comes from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation and from the National Endowment for the Humanities.
Women, Work, and the American City. Two conversations this week on Soundings. Listen for Sarah Deutsch of the Massachusetts Institute of Technology and Virginia Valian of Hunter College. Sarah Deutsch discusses her study, Women of Boston, Gender and the City, 1870 through 1950. Virginia Valian talks about gender and the psychology of work. Women, Work, and the American City. This week on Soundings.